I'm only going to say a few words, but I want to talk about our motto. We believe in order to understand. That's what Augustine understood, and the modern university disagrees about. They think you understand in order to believe. But if they took a moment's thought, they'd realize that that's not possible. That's not the way it works. What you believe determines what you can understand. When I'm in Africa, working with people whose belief system is animist, it is impossible to do nutrition education. Because if the world is controlled by evil spirits, then what has what you eat got to do with it? I'm the one guilty of a narrow way of thought from their perspective when I say that the child who is sick of malnutrition should have been fed and I want to give him food, but they say the problem is an evil spirit has taken away his appetite. That's what needs dealing with. Who is guilty of superficial thought in that particular one? Well, I am, if their view of the world is right. Certainly they won't take my view. So modern science, applied science, taken to Africa, doesn't work. Many of my colleagues, doctors, go out there and they do medicine, and they set up mission hospitals, and when the missionaries leave, many of those hospitals collapse within a year or two because the underpinnings are not there. The cultural history that made hospitals possible is very old. It's 8 centuries or more. We need to understand those things. We're running into problems in that area all over the place now. The loss of the deeper things of life, which are essential to the trivial things which we spend all our time on. Perhaps the most interesting conversation I've had in the last year or two was in the University of Chicago, where, amazingly, I ended up doing grand rounds. I'm well past my sell-by date as a trendy scientist, so that wasn't the reason I was there. It was actually a God thing, but that's another story. But nevertheless, I ended up doing grand rounds in the University of Chicago. It's a big deal there. You don't just give an hour's talk and that's it. You're there for 2 or 3 days teaching. And they look after you very well. They didn't have to look after me. They called me and said, we booked you in a nice hotel. And I said, well, you can undo the booking. I'm staying with my friend in Southside. They said, it's dangerous in Southside. I said, I know. He runs the oldest clinic for the indigent poor in North America, but he'll look after me and get me wherever you need me to be. And he's much more fun than any hotel you can find. So they cancelled the hotel, wondering who they had invited. But they did take the trouble to say, is there anybody in the University of Chicago you'd like to meet? And I said, well, actually, there is. I would very much like to meet Robert Fogel, if that's possible. And they said, we can arrange that. Now, Robert Fogel won the first Nobel Prize for econometrics a good many years ago. The reason I wanted to see him was that someone had sent me a book of his a few years ago in which he predicted the financial meltdown, not directly, but implicitly. The book was called The Fourth Great Awakening. Now, Robert Fogel is a secular Jew born in New York and spent his life in Chicago. So I was rather amazed to read a book in which the opening chapters were dedicated to the absolutely essential contribution made to America by the revivals under the Puritans, Jonathan Edwards, and even including Finney. That was not what I expected from a secular Jew. And the next thing he said was that he thinks a new awakening is underway, and he hopes that it is because it's essential. About halfway through the book, he gives his list of the things that are going to be essential to the survival of America, and they are all, of course, virtues. And as he points out, if you don't acquire them before you go to school, you probably won't. That is the problem. They're in order of importance, and number 15, the one you need least of, is self-esteem. It's an incredible book. Well, when I got to see him, I asked him, what did your fellow Nobel laureates make of this book? And he said, they didn't engage. They didn't know what to do with it. And I said to him, well, why did you write it? And he said, well, I am a secular Jew. I'm still a secular Jew. He must be about 80 now. But he said, I did a very un-Jewish thing. I married a black Episcopalian lady. And she had died a year or two earlier. And he said, I missed her dearly. And I realized after she had gone that the reason I was proud of my children was not anything that I had done, but what she had done. the virtues that are or are not implanted in children before they get to kindergarten, in principle, are the ones that make them good citizens or not. And he understood that. And he realized that the deficit in North America is not going to be filled by the university or by technology or by money, because the deficit is spiritual, ultimately. It's in character and it's in virtue. It was an interesting conversation. It was even more interesting as I had the privilege of reminding him where that idea came from, because being a secular Jew, he didn't know what followed the Shema Israel. These things shall be upon your heart, speaking to fathers, and you shall teach them diligently to your children in the domestic setting, not in church, not at school, but in a domestic setting. And when children grow up, knowing all the stories of the Bible, which are all morally consequential, their default system for good and evil is solid. Now, that is what mind means in the Bible. The mind is not some brilliant instrument with which we decimate others' opinions or show off. The mind in the Bible is what we just read about in Philippians. It is a fixed and solid way of being that ultimately expresses, if it's a Christian mind, the character of Christ. We hope in this course to do something towards making that happen, to be at least useful. The whole program started, as Edward constantly reminds me, I thought we were about a dozen years in. Obviously, we're more than that. I don't keep records of such things. I think I'm the only one left who's been there since the beginning. But it's lovely to see you all here and to see the numbers increasing. The reason we started it was because we had seen our students lose their way, lose their faith as they went through the secular university. I did that myself, not in the sense of ceasing to believe, but never being able to integrate what I believed into the practice of medicine in the way that I should have done. Those of you who are doctors or medical here know that we constantly default to solving the immediate problem without consideration of whether there are any consequences to that which are worse than the solution. And of course, there have been many over my lifetime. Hence, never have you had more power to treat disease, and never have been patients more likely to litigate against you. That's a bit of a strange conundrum, isn't it? And you go to Africa, where frequently you run out of medicines, and they say thank you. It took me a long while to begin to realize what was going on here. But we are in trouble, because we're losing our foundations. And houses without foundations cannot exist for long. It is not what can be physically demonstrated that is open to the general public in every way that is fundamental to what the institutions we've developed and who we are. As Christians, we have defaulted to their model of presenting the gospel, in my view, frequently. If you try to present the gospel in post-endarkment rational terms, you will get what you deserve: a utilitarian approach to faith. Jesus doesn't recommend that. My favorite example, of course, is Nicodemus. Now, Nicodemus, in our terms, was a professor. And like all academics, he was envious of people who did the job better than him. There is no group who are more envious and petty than academics. And so he doesn't want them to know what he thinks, so he comes by night. And his real question to Jesus is, how can I teach like you? And Jesus' answer is basically, well, you can't get to there from here. It wasn't a helpful answer. But ultimately it got to Nicodemus, as we see him at Calvary playing his part. Jesus said, unless you are born of the Spirit, you cannot comprehend what you want to know. Nicodemus wanted the spiritual authority that Jesus had and thought it was his for the asking. And we often present the gospel that way, don't we? Hilariously, in a Methodist church, I used to hear people say, become a Christian now, sitting under a picture of John Wesley. Now, if you don't see the ironies in that combination, you need to rethink a little bit. John Wesley would put us all to shame in terms of what he did as a Christian. But he wasn't born again. He didn't know Christ. He got a degree in theology. He visited the poor. He visited the prisoners. He became a missionary to America, and you hated him because he was a prig. They sent him back, in fact. He comes back, and as a minister, he's asked to go and speak to some men who are about to be executed, and he tells them what he believes to be the gospel, and they understand it in a way that he doesn't, and they repent, and they die joyful. And he writes in his journal, "I can save others, but who will save me?" And then his brother Charles discovers the Moravian mission in the back streets of London, in Aldersgate Street. And his heart is strangely warm. But John was too snobbish. He'd gone to St. Paul's and listened to a beautiful rendition of Evensong. And when he comes back, his brother says, "You've got to come with me to this little church in Aldersgate Street." And in effect, John says, "What have they got to tell me?" But Charles is persuasive. And he goes. And then, while a man, presumably, probably in broken English, is not even reading the Bible, but Luther's introduction to the book of Romans, John Wesley writes in his journal, "My heart was strangely warmed, and I knew for the first time that I was a child of God." The rest, as they say, is history. The same happened to Whitfield, and the two of them transformed England in a matter of months, literally. The French had a bloody revolution. The English had Wesley and Whitfield and the Clapham sect, which in due course led to the abolition of slavery, the reform of the prisons, the abolition of child labour, the change in the economics of the whole system. But the initial step cannot be described in a way that is acceptable to a secularist. And one of the things we hope the students go away from here with is the ability to tell the story of conversion based on what happened in a way that is winsome and that forces the secularists back on their heels. I love it when occasionally on my travels I meet someone who knew me earlier in my career as a trendy scientist. And of course nowadays if you're lecturing in the US, well, around the world now, there's invariably a picture of you up somewhere. They get it off the web. Now, my hair colour has changed, but facially I'm still recognisable. And just occasionally somebody turns up who knows me from the period when science was my life. And they'll say, especially if they're British and therefore straightforwardly rude, they will say, "I haven't seen you for some time." And I say, "No, I don't go to those meetings anymore." And they'll say, "Yes, I used to read your stuff until the early 90s. The clear implication being that I lost my mind in the early 90s. And I say, "You think I lost it?" And they say, "Yeah, you write rubbish now, don't you?" And I say, "Well, if you're accusing me of being irrational now, I think I can show that you're wrong. What do you call someone who is truly irrational?" And of course the answer is mad or crazy. "What happens to their life?" "Well, it falls apart. They lose their marriage, they lose their job, they lose everything." Now, when I started taking faith more seriously, that didn't happen. Even my wife, who's not prejudiced in my favour on these issues, will probably acknowledge some minor improvement. You see, faith doesn't destroy your ability to do things. It makes it better, not worse. So my faith is not irrational, I say. It would be better to call it suprarational. Your problem is to confuse endarkment rationality with being a total explanation of what it means to be rational. It isn't. It's partial. There's no explanation for why babies come into this world knowing that they have a right to expect fidelity from their parents and can get you out of bed and get you driving down to CHEO, the local children's hospital, all to prove their power over you. They come out knowing that's your duty. The first thing they say is philosophical. It's not fair. And so it goes on. Those things are not explicable by Chomsky or anyone else. We come hardwired. Children know that fidelity is their right, which is why all of the generation we're teaching now, without exception, I can say this in any university on the continent, I know you all hate divorce. Do the young people ever disagree with me? No. They hate it too. They may have parents who needed to divorce and eventually they recognize it, but did any child ever enjoy the divorce of its parents? Of course not. Those parents were not properly counseled before marriage. They made foolish marriages or whatever. But the way forward is not to get the children to say, it's all right, it's okay, but to go and say, I'm sorry, don't screw up like we did. I know this has caused pain. That's the way to start, because it's true. And the young know it. So the men, in particular, are very cautious about entering into marriage because they're afraid of the failure that happened to them. The women get over divorce much better than the men do. In their families. But the men need a lot of help. And the way forward is truth and repentance, not pretending that things are other than they are. Augustine was very good at rubbing the world's nose in that sort of thing. Lovely lines like, I know many men who like to deceive, but none who like to be deceived. Objective moral truth is written in every soul. Hopefully, by the time we have finished here, the ability to say that in a more winsome way will be one of the results. We know by this stage that most of our students who go off to the university come out the other end with a flourishing faith. Whereas, send the average bright young person from an evangelical or an Orthodox Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox church to university, and they will not engage with the professors in a way where the professors back off because they don't know how to. The issues that matter are not discussed in church. We will do that here and hopefully get the results we want and you want. Animals simply are. We are different, Peter Singer notwithstanding. A barracuda with moral scruples is impossible to imagine, isn't it? We are angst-ridden, the animals are not. But the questions that focus our angst, where did I come from, why am I here, where am I going, death, suffering, justice, what can I know, therefore what ought I to believe, therefore what ought I to do, those questions are not discussed by most young people. Most young people have never heard them put together as the one course in which you must attempt to answer every question. They won't get through the course here without facing those questions. And then they can go back and perhaps get their churches to attack those questions too. But I have to warn you that learning is dangerous, particularly if your church is truly a believing church but has made the mistakes that most of the churches have made over the last little while of switching off their minds. It is difficult. I spend every other week, I appear to be staying in a home with somebody who was one thing and is now another. There's a two-way traffic going on between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. People whose minds are turned on to think Christianly look around for authoritative teaching and they migrate towards the Catholic Church for the magisterium and the mystery of the Mass, and the homily is mercifully brief. Unfortunately, in the Catholic Church, there are still many places with liberal priests who do not actually believe you can get saved. I meet them in the Protestant Church because they go off to university, their lives get screwed up, and then some woolly Pentecostal comes and gives them a great big hug and says, you must meet Jesus. And by the grace of God, they do, and their lives are turned around. It's very hard for them to forgive a church that kept that possibility of relationship secret. So this two-way traffic is going on. Both sides will benefit. I hope that the Protestant Church will come to honour the sacraments, especially the Lord's Supper, more deeply. And I hope that John Paul II and Benedict will get their desire that the Catholic Church become more evangelistic, as Christ was. So your children are in a little danger of being discontented with your church when they get back. Listen to them and perhaps you can change your church for the better. How will we know at the end of all this whether we've succeeded? Well, it's not our job. Our job is to do what we believe to be right, to teach what we believe to be true and leave the rest to God. He knows what he's doing, even though we don't. But I can guarantee that this will be, for most of them at least, a joyful learning experience. Some tell me afterwards they were terrified every day and it took them a year to recover, but then they too became joyful. So it's better to start that way. But thank you for listening, and I look forward to meeting you after the service.